Okay, anybody have any questions? Jagadish says, do the Vedas say something about the future of the planet? I don't know if the Vedas say anything. The Puranas say something. The Kalki Purana for Kali Yuga, this fourth Yuga that we're in. They do say some things that Swamiji's told me about. I have never really gone through and read the Kalki Purana for the Kali Yuga. They talk about the mixing pot of humanity, that we all become kind of, we all look the same, but we also become much shorter and smaller. And that's what, and I'm just repeating what Swamiji's told me. I don't remember reading this. It's just things that he's mentioned in the past. The Vedas become books on bookshelves instead of things that are held in your mind. Knowledge in your mind, it's knowledge that's put like on a bookshelf. So they talk about that, which is kind of interesting. The cultures all break down and blend together. You know, it's not a very happy situation. The trees all become short, small, things like that. But on a positive note, for the mumukshus, the people who are seekers, who are seeking self-knowledge, for them this knowledge becomes very available, because there's so few of them, for one thing, and the environment is not conducive for really gaining self-knowledge. And so the mumukshu means the one who desires liberation, literally, is that that's what it means. For that mumukshu, the universe conspires greatly to help you gain what you need. Now, in terms of the future of the planet, whether the Earth will continue to live or how that's going to work out, it may say something, but I don't know. I mean, there are. I don't think they would accept that there's just one Earth, and then when that Earth dies, all life is gone. It's an infinite universe, you know, with many, many planets and probably many Earths and plenty of everything. But this planet that we are on at this time, how is that going to resolve? Is the Earth going to die, and are all beings on the Earth going to die? Or will all humans on the Earth die soon enough for the Earth to survive? You know, I don't know. I don't know if the Puranas talk about this kind of cataclysmic state that we find ourselves in now. They might. It might be talked about somewhere, but I don't know.
Who asked that?
Jagadish. So Jagadish says, fortunately in this limitless universe there are many lokas. Smile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's limitless time also. And it's cyclical. So we'll have another chance. Might be in several million years, but it's okay. Time will pass. The meditations we've been doing lately, let me just talk a little bit about those, because I think, I'm not sure if they're working or not, but I wanted to explain them a little bit. You know the metaphor, the story we use about the sun illumining the water bucket, whether it be a muddy water bucket or a clear water bucket or an agitated water bucket. When we talk about the ahankara, means ahankara, literally it's a Sanskrit word, it means the I notion, or creating an I somewhere on something that it's not. Mm-hmm. Like for instance, if I put the I am, the word the I am, onto this body, so then it becomes I am this body, my being and this body become as though one. It's a notion that I have, where my own being is conflated, superimposed upon the body, which is actually an experience that I objectify. I'm aware of, with my five sense organs, I'm aware of this body as an object. And at the same time, I can say, I am this. Even though there's a subject-object relationship between me and the body, if I say, I am the body, then the word I, is landing on the body, the object, instead of landing on me, the subject, right? And so normally we don't even think about that, that superimposition is where I operate from within that superimposition of I am the body. Or I'm operating from within the superimposition of I am my mind, or I am worried, I am happy, I am angry. Whatever the emotional state of the mind is, I am that. That's what we mean by ahankara, this I notion. I've let the word I, which identifies me, the subject, is now landing on the object that I'm aware of. See what I mean? Mm. That's why we call it an ahankara. But if I just relax for a minute and am totally with my experience, and I just accept it for what it is. I don't engage with it. I just simply allow it to be. I give it a right to exist. I give this body a right to exist in its own right. I just let the experience, physical experience, be there without doing anything about it. It's okay. It's fine. You just be as you are. Whatever my thoughts are, I just relax. I let them be as they are. And then I recognize all of these thoughts, even the physical perception of the body, all of them are experiences that I'm aware of. I'm aware of the experience of my body. I'm aware of the experience of my shoulder, you know, or of any hurt toe or whatever. I'm aware of the experience of my body. I'm aware of the experience of my mind, of my thoughts, my worries, my emotions. And just letting them be as they are. And now I have this little recognition of, in fact, they are experiences that I'm having. They are objects of experience. That's a big step. Once I've recognized them as objects of experience, I can then differentiate me, the subject of the experience. Right. Once I notice this, these things that usually I'm just saying, I am this, and I am this, and I am this body, or I am tired, or I am, you know, young or old, or whatever identification I have with the body, or I am happy, I am sad. Once I stop for a minute, recognize these are just experiences that I'm aware of, then I can shift. My mind can shift its focus to the one who's illumining, the one who is the subject. That's what we mean by viveka, or differentiation. If I don't make that differentiation, or I haven't been been taught to recognize that there is a differentiation there between me and my experiences, then I'm always the experiences. It's as though I'm living out of the experience. The me is coming out of the experience rather than I am the one in whom the experience is arising and setting. It's just a very different internal space. So what if you relax and just allow your experiences to be, and then you let the mind focus on the fact that these experiences are objectified and coming and going, and then recognizes, turns its attention to me, the one who's not coming and going. It's not that the mind is the one who becomes the luminary of me. It's not. It's just the mind is recognizing that it is the objectified one. And letting that be as it is, then I just let myself be, I just abide as myself. It's the me that's illumining these experiences. And then I just be me. Because it sounds simple, but it is simple. It's ridiculously simple. But it means nothing. It can't be done. This, what I'm talking about, really can't be done without recognizing this differentiation between subject and object, between me and the experiences. Now, the me experiences, like in the analogy that I use of the sun, the self experience, if the sun is the self, the sun experience belongs to the sun. Right? The sun experience doesn't belong to the water, and it doesn't even belong to the reflection of in the water. The reflection in the water is like that ahankara, where I'm taking myself to be one with the water. But that's not where the sun experience is located. The sun experience is located in the sun, right? It has no experience in the water. Its experience is in the sun. And that's your situation. Your self-experience is in the self. It's not in the experiences that are coming and going. And it's always in the self. The self-experience is in the self. The mind takes my self-experience to belong to it, where it says, I am happy, I am sad, etc. So that differentiation has to take place so that the mind recognizes itself as being illumined, objectified. And then you notice your self-experience is differentiated from that. And then you just allow yourself to simply be you as these experiences are coming and going. You don't have to do anything. It's already a given. It's already a given fact. But you have to relax and just be yourself. Let go of all of these experiences, because the mind gets too involved with itself. Thinking about itself, thinking about this thought, thinking about that thought, and building a whole web, like a web, or a web of thoughts. So it doesn't even have time to do this differentiation. So that's why I'm saying you just let go of all of the experiences, give them a right to be, accept them, welcome them. Don't say you have to be like this or you have to be like that. You just let them be. And then see, recognize, then you just be yourself. Once this differentiation takes place, and see who you are. You see what I mean? Who are you? You're the one you've, and what's so funny is when you recognize this, you're the one you've always been. You're the one who is never not there. The experiences don't touch you in any way. But until you make that differentiation, you can't notice how stable you are and how beautiful the self, the very core being that makes me, me, is. Because we're always getting entangled in these objectified experiences that are actually coming and going. So we have to slow everything down, let go of everything, and just abide as myself, letting all of these experiences come and go. You are already abiding as yourself. This is not something that you have to do. You're already abiding as yourself, but the mind is confused and taking itself to be you. And so there's this conflation that goes on between the experience, like the emotion, for instance, the emotion and yourself. But actually, yourself is just illumining that emotion. Yourself is not doing anything. It's never done anything. It's always exactly the same. And those emotions and feelings don't touch it in any way. They don't touch you in any way, not at all, zero. But of course, we won't notice that if we're looking at myself through the lens of the emotion, rather than being myself and recognizing the emotion as what is illumined and coming and going. Right, so it's all exquisitely simple, but it has to be, these little things have to be recognized, and then it's like the pieces of the puzzle kind of all fall into place and you see it. Otherwise you don't see it because of the superimposition that goes from beginningless time until it's pointed out. Because why shouldn't the mind just say, I am me? Because whenever you have a thought, whenever a thought is there, whenever an emotion is there, I am there. Mm-hmm. It's not like I'm not there. So why shouldn't, from the mind's perspective, say, I am that? See what I mean? Because whenever the mind is, I am there, so why shouldn't the mind say, that's me? In fact, it is me. It's true also, because I am the self of every thought. But the thing is, the thoughts come and go and I don't. Mm-hmm. And so even though I'm the self of every thought, the thoughts are coming and going and changing, and I'm not. So now if that's understood, I can just relax and just be me and have that become more clear. Then I have a solid core. You always have a solid core anyway. But when you don't know that, when the mind doesn't know it, it's responding to your experiences in a way that as though usurps that solid core, even though it's there. Do you understand? It's really makes a huge difference in terms of your kind of inner orientation to your whole life and experience and to yourself.
If that's so simple and so obvious, why is it universally missed?
It's universally missed because the mind and the sense organs are all externally directed. You know? And so it doesn't even stop to say, well, who am I really? Once it does that, then you're on your way to being a mumukshu and needing to gain self-knowledge. But normally that question doesn't come up because whatever thought or feeling or emotion is there in the mind, whatever perception, whatever relationship, whatever situation you find yourself in from the standpoint of the mind and the body, I am there. And so I am always, who I am is always being answered by the condition that I'm experiencing, because the mind always, the experience of the mind always involves me. If I'm not there, then there is no experience of the mind. Right? And so it's always just taking itself, whatever the experience is, to be me. So we have to switch that around and say, wait a minute. All these experiences are coming and going. I'm remaining. You know? I'm not going, I don't go anywhere. I'm the constant. But until I recognize that, I'm never the constant because the mind is not constant. I don't even know about a constant. The mind takes itself to be me, and the mind is always changing. But that's not really the experience. Really the experience is, I am here, and all of these experiences are coming and going in me, and the constant. But to recognize it, I need this discrimination between subject and object, or I won't even know. The mind doesn't know to make that differentiation until it until somehow it gets this, what we call really grace. Call it the Bhagavan's grace, Ishwara's grace. That you have enough shanti, enough peace in your mind to reflect on this in this way. Who am I really in all of this? You know? And then it becomes quite simple. But your mind has to be ready for it, to have the question.
Did you say something about when other people label you and the confusion that that might cause?
Yeah, Andrew says, would you say something about when other people label you, you know, and the confusion that might cause? I would actually say it doesn't necessarily cause any more confusion than's already there. You know, because you're already labeling also. Yeah. So then it's when you stop labeling, it's in a real way, it's because that differentiation has taken place and you've recognized. And so then when other people are labeling you, you know exactly what they're doing because that's what you were always doing also.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? Yeah. How come we're all such a quiet group tonight?
Oh, they're not asking?
Mm-mm, neither are you.
I
don't mind. I don't mind being a quiet group. It's fine with me. I'm quiet too.
Well, what, you know, there's a, you can know yourself as you are. You can make that discernment and that differentiation of between subject and object, and yet still behave as though you don't know. There was a Sanskrit technical word for that. And what causes that also?
Edward says, you know, you can make this discrimination between yourself and the other, and yet you know that, but you act as though you don't know.
That's right.
I think that's the main problem. One of the main problems in the whole Vedanta are maturing into this knowledge is what we call lack of vairagya. And lack of vairagya means, in fact, often Shankara equates vairagya to knowledge. Vairagya means, it's hard to translate it, but it means dispassion. But dispassion, by the word dispassion, what we mean is, like we use the, Swamiji uses the example, if a child has a helium balloon, little child, and they're hanging on to it, but of course they lose it. It gets loose and it goes up into the sky and they're so upset about the loss of their helium balloon. Right? They have no dispassion toward that helium balloon.
Mm.
You know, to have dispassion or vairagya toward the helium balloon would be more probably the relationship an adult would have to it, which would be, you really don't expect that helium balloon to last forever. You don't expect that at all. It would be fine if it got loose and flew up into the sky, or if it deflated and lost all its air, it would be fine. That's a helium balloon. That's how it is. My well-being has nothing to do with the helium balloon.
Yeah.
That's dispassion.
Yeah.
And so I can enjoy it completely while it's there. If I don't have it, if somebody takes it away, if it pops, if it goes up into the sky, that's absolutely fine. And so I'm totally free to enjoy the helium balloon because I don't have any false expectations on it. I'm not attached to it. I have vairagya. For jnani, for somebody who's really mature in their knowledge, the whole world is a helium balloon. You know, I can be with the situations that Ishwara gives me. Ishwara means the Lord. Whatever the situation is, that's my helium balloon. I can be with it. You know, I can respond to it. I can do my dharma. What is the appropriate way to behave in that? My well-being is simply not at stake at all. You know, when that's the case, then I'm just being myself. See, I'm being myself. I am myself anyway. But my mind can be creating so much havoc because of lack of vairagya. I need this so that I can be happy. I need this from the world so that I can be happy. I need this from my body so I can be happy. I need this from my mind so that I can be happy. I have so many demands, I can't just be with what is. But what about when I recognize that really my own being is the very source of ananda, my own being, fullness. By my nature, I'm fine. There's no problem from my own standpoint. So what if when my mind has given up all of these painful attachments, somehow I think, even in spite of my knowledge, I still, these things are hanging on. Like, I need to have this, or I need to have this, or I need this kind of security, I need this, I need that. So we have hundreds of them in different levels of subtlety. So you find yourself outgrowing these things. In the light of your knowledge, you outgrow them. And then they no longer, they're all become helium balloons. They can be there, they cannot be there. My well-being's not at stake, you know. But until all of these things, and, you know, I mean, we have baggage. We have a lot of conditioning, a lot of things that, a lot of traumas and childhood things that we bring with us. A lot of things that our parents have super values that have been superimposed upon us, how we're supposed to be a success, our whole concept of being successful, all of these type of things, you know. That all has to unwind in the light of my knowledge. And one thing, you know, these painful experiences are your greatest sadhana. They are your sadhana, the painful experiences, because there's a place where it's not a helium balloon right there. Mm-hmm. So there's something for you to work on, to let that experience go, to let it be. And recognize that you're not touched by it at all. Now letting it be, letting it, not clinging, letting it go, that doesn't mean that I don't have some duty in reference to that experience. Something that's being asked of me, something that I need to do. It's just that something that's appropriate, how to handle this situation. That's all there. What isn't there is that my well-being is not at stake. And so I'm free to be appropriate in the situation and do what needs to be done. There's a lot more to this, actually, because the more you... I'm just doing it really from the standpoint of the individual right now, but on a whole nother level, this body, mind, sense organs is part of a greater whole. You know, it's not like you're here all by yourself. You're totally interconnected with the whole universe, actually. You know? And so when you understand that, and that your being, in fact, isn't doing anything, at all. You're just simply, you're beings, you simply are. Then this body, mind, sense organs actually belongs to the universe. It belongs to Ishvara. And when you realize that, then you can simply do your dharma, what's being asked of you in any given situation. And you don't need to do any more than that, really, because it's not like whatever you do is going to change your being or make you happy or make you sad in terms of your being. Nothing happens to you. And you're, the way you, who you are, is fine. In fact, you can't improve yourself. There's no way to improve. You can improve your body, you can improve your mind and, you know, your skills and all of that. But you can't improve you. Nor do you want to, you know. So I have a lot of freedom to just do what's already being asked of me. So it's more, your life becomes more of responding to what's being asked of you rather than thinking you're creating it. If you're thinking you're creating it, that's delusional, and it's very painful also.
So when you have a sense that you want to improve yourself or...
It's all right to want to improve your mind, improve your body because it's needs some help, it's sick. Or your mind is causing you some pain, so you want to make some adjustments and improve that.
But
that's all objective. You're responding to some pain, and so you're doing what needs to be done to improve it. But you're not improving yourself. So being myself, which I cannot improve and I can't make worse, I take care of these things in the world that need to be taken care of. I do what needs to be done. And abiding as me. I learn how to just be me and come from that perspective.
And then it's mm-hmm. not determined, this me. Me is not determined by the success or failure of the activity, because you're not looking for yourself in that.
No, because you know yourself. That's why you. That's why I said, once that subject object is recognized, once you recognize yourself, then you. If you, once that has happened, then you can be yourself.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can never be yourself because yourself is. You're always interpreting yourself through the lens of some emotional state. So you think that's you. Like, I'm so happy. I'm so sad. I'm so agitated. I'm so hurt. I'm so this. I'm so that. You know. But actually, you're not at all. You're always exactly the same. And these states are going on changing. But you have to have that differentiation to be able to recognize that. And then you never don't recognize. As you start to know yourself, and these guided meditations are very helpful because, along with just listening to these unfoldments, it's very helpful because it slows everything down and it lets you just sit there and be that. And then after a while, then when you're out active and all of that, you just are that. Because you are that anyway. It's just your mind isn't used to recognizing that.
Well, how does the contemplation help you notice that in your daily affairs?
Because can notice it in contemplation, it's not any less there in your daily affairs.
Yeah.
But your mind has to start having a value for recognizing that rather than getting upset with all the helium balloons that are running around.
Yeah.
It takes time. So Hal asks a question. What determines when and if someone becomes a mumukshu, some critical amount of punya or what? Well, actually, I think that is kind of true, some critical amount of punya. Because another way of saying that is that when your mind... When you are committed to dharma rather than to your raga dvesha's, your likes and dislikes, like, I need this to be happy and I need to get rid of this to be happy. That's the normal commitment, pleasure and pain and trying to create pleasurable experiences for myself and, you know. When as I just mature, just as a human being, not as a jnani, not as one who's self-knowledge, just as a human being, more and more you come to recognize that what matters is dharma, not your pleasure and pain. If there's dharma there, if the pleasure is there within dharma, then that's fine. Mm-hmm. But if the pleasure is there but requires a dharma in order to have that pleasure, that is not fine. And we discover that as we move along and assimilate our human experience. So as a person becomes more dharmic, they are accruing punya because they're in harmony with the universe, actually, with the nature of the universe. And as they... somebody's off. Let's see here. As they gain that shanti from dharma, the mind has the inner space to ask these relevant questions, because their mind isn't now running all around trying to fulfill itself through pleasure, you know, seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. So it has space, the mind has space to ask these questions. And that the mind has gained that space to ask these questions, the who am I type questions, you know, that's considered Ishwara's grace, or the grace of punya. So anyway, Hal, I think, even though maybe that sounds funny, I think it's kind of true.
What was it?
We have to unfold it.
How did he phrase that again?
He said, what determines when and if someone becomes a mumukshu? Mumukshu means one who desires liberation. And to desire liberation, I could say, if only I could astral travel, I would be liberated. Well, that's not the desire we're meaning. We mean the one who has recognized that fundamental problem, that there is no possibility of becoming whole and complete, where I can say all is well with me, by fulfilling some desires. Mm-hmm. Because you're trying to fulfill desire something that you want as a reality of your being by fulfilling temporal desires, you know, time-bound desires. It's not going to work. So at some point you recognize that. So Sue says, once someone has knowledge of who they are but is still distracted by the helium balloons, is that person continuing to create karma? Probably. I mean, we're content as long as we're alive. Really, we're creating karma in the form of punya and papa. You know, but the thing is, with a person who's a mumukshu, who's seeking self-knowledge, you come to the recognition that yourself has no karma. The self has no karma. You know. And that's what frees you from karma. And also, you become someone who is not trying to gain karma one way or the other. You're not trying to gain punya and avoid papa. You're trying to avoid papa only in the sense that it's a dharma. And you're gaining punya only in the sense that your commitment is to dharma. But you don't really care anymore about punya and papa. You care about the self that is free of punya and papa and free of karma. So that question of karma resolves itself in self-knowledge. And any punya or papa that you've accrued along the way is also resolved, because the self has never had any karma in the first place and never will. So that's kind of, if that makes sense, Sue.
Yeah, it makes sense, but it's kind of paradoxical because...
It is a little...
I mean, when I hear you say it, it makes me want to kind of just giggle about it.
She's up in here.
I mean, there's a real irony there, right? I mean,
Yeah. It's paradoxical, but once you understand it, it's not a paradox. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So Virginia asks, I find that it is easy when I am sad to feel that it will always be this way, which creates a kind of desperate despair anxiety. I'm curious why there is the sensation of permanence by the mind of a particular emotional state. I don't, well, that's interesting because they even talk about that, and Swamiji talks about that as kind of a joke, you know, and I do too, where we, you know, if you look at your experience of sukha, which is pleasure, and dukkha is pain, as kind of a wave where you're going up the top of the wave and now you have sukha, pleasure, and you know that you're going to be falling down soon, right? So you're up at the top, you're this nice sukha, pleasurable experience, and the fear comes that this isn't going to last, and you know it's not going to last. And then you get under the bottom, you're at the bottom, you know, of the wave, and now that's dukkha, and now you feel, I'm never going to get out of this.
Yeah, forever.
Yeah, I'm in that forever. You know, why is that? I don't know. Maybe because one of it, on the dukkha, we fear the dukkha. But sukha, we fear the loss of the sukha, mm-hmm. You know?
So they're both fear-based.
Yeah, but one's different. Like the sukha, I'm fearing, I want to stay there. My desire is to stay there, and I fear the loss.
Yeah, forever. Right? Let's freeze this moment.
And I know that I'll be lost, but with the dukkha, I don't want to stay there. And I don't know if I'll ever get out of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, there's no guarantee.
Well, there is a guarantee because everything changes, and I've always been out of it before, but we don't realize that.
Yeah.
The sukha I want, so there's no problem experiencing sukha. And then I just don't want to lose it. But the dukkha, I don't want. And so I want it to go, I want it to go, I want it to go. So I think that's how it is. One thing, again, about that is it becomes, your dukkha experiences become useful. Because, in fact, the dukkha is not covering yourself. Just like the sun is illumining the muddy water, the sun is not being tainted or affected at all by the muddy water that it's illumining. You know? Even though I think a better example is when we talk about the sun illumining the rain clouds. Say there's a thunderstorm. Huge dark clouds with a big thunderstorm. The person on the ground looks up at the thunderstorm and is getting wet by the rain and can't see the sun at all. All they can see is the thunderstorm, you know. That's for the person on the ground. But I'm the sun. So for me, the sun, it makes no difference at all. For my experience as the sun, it makes no difference at all whether I'm illumining clear skies or illumining a rain cloud. I'm not becoming tainted or dimmed by the rain cloud. You see that? And I'm not becoming bright by the lack of clouds either. And so that's my inner reality, actually. If I'm illumining the rain cloud of my mind, you know, nothing's happening to me and I'm not covered. The self-experience is not covered by the mental state that I'm illumining. At all, zero. But I'm not used to thinking like that or recognizing that fact. I'm used to being attached to the sukhavrittis, means the clear skies, and not the rain clouds. Because the clear skies don't in any way from their own vantage point cover me. Or the rain clouds from their vantage point cover me. But from my vantage point, I'm just illuminating both of them equally. And that's what I say, don't worry about the experience. Let it be, give it its right to be. Just be yourself, be the sun. Notice the fact of it. Hal says, makes sense, thanks. That's for the Mumukshu question, yeah. Let's see, Rob's got a question here. Oh, Rob says thanks. You're welcome, Rob.
But that thanks, when someone says thanks, that it's a style of recognition of understanding what you said. You know, the thanks originates from that place.
Yeah, thanks, I've got it, I understand. Jagadish says, that is a great statement.
What?
Be the sun. It is. Pranams, Om Namaha.
That's from Australia.
Yes, and Virginia says, yes, be the sun.
Well, you talk worldwide in current time, don't you?
What do you mean?
Fixing all these prices.
Sure.
What if you have the knowledge that you aren't these experiences, but you don't feel connected to the self?
What did you say?
What if you have the knowledge that you aren't all of these experiences, but you don't feel connected to the self? That involves nididhyasana, where you actually get to know yourself. Because you're not connected to yourself, you are yourself. You know?
Yeah,
so,
that's true. So
the thing is, there's a subtle... that differentiation is helpful, but in nididhyasana, when you just be yourself and let the mind then come into relationship.
Yeah.
Well, you let the mind come into that. Once you recognize yourself, the mind has differentiated itself from you. Then the mind, having differentiated itself, now has to come back into relationship with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that you, even though this is getting into another level, but you are the reality that the mind enjoys. You know, kind of like the clay is of a clay pot, the clay is the reality of the pot. The pot's not away from the clay, and your mind isn't away from you at all. Your mind is the very you are the very self of the mind. You are its truth, but the mind doesn't know that, and so it's taking you to belong to it, and then whatever statement, whatever thought it has, whatever emotion, suffering, you know. So now what has to happen is that the mind has to be, like the pot has to be differentiated from the clay, and then it has to come back into relationship with the clay. So your mind that's been differentiated as not you now has to come back into relationship with you so that it recognizes the changeless me. The changeless me becomes dominant in every thought, like the clay should become dominant in the pot. From the standpoint of the pot, it's really there's only clay there. And you have to become dominant from the standpoint of the mind, as a gestalt, you know, where your being comes more to the forefront, you know. And then you don't feel separated from yourself, because now the mind can just run around saying, well, I know I'm not this experience, but it's not enjoying the truth of who it is. It's just enjoying who it isn't.
Well, if you're...
Does that make sense? Enjoying who it isn't, like it's... Well, like if you say, I know I'm not the experience, I know I'm not this experience, I know I'm not that experience.
Mm-hmm.
But then that ahankar, that I has to resolve into the me that I am. It can even know that, but it's not doing that thing.
Yeah.
Then it becomes okay.
Well, if you're already connected to yourself, who then is the one saying that you're not?
The mind.
So it's
the mind's the one that's got the problem.
Yeah.
All the ignorance belongs to the mind.
Yeah.
See, it's very tricky. It's the if you use the clay pot example, it's like the pot saying, "I am the clay." Mm-hmm. And it is the clay. It's true, right? The pot is the clay. But what it doesn't realize is that the clay is totally free from the pot. Mm-hmm. That's the tricky thing. So your mind has to say, you know, I am the self, and I, the self, am completely free from the mind. It's like all experiences have for their self me, but I am totally free from all those experiences. And so this little thing of recognizing me as the constant, because I am the constant. Nothing ever happens to me at all. Not at all zero. And I'm never covered.
Is it the mind that chooses then between this or that? Or?
Yes, but it can't just choose because it needs some knowledge. That's why something like a spiritual tradition like this one has to hold up a mirror to the mind and then it sees. Until then, it's just taking for granted the oneness of itself with, like if the pot is taking for granted its oneness with the clay without recognizing the nature of the clay in reference to itself, because it is the clay. So your mind is taking for granted its oneness with the self, but the mind is always changing and the self is never changing. So it's not the same relationship going from self to mind as going from mind to self. See what I mean? Not the same relationship going from pot to clay as going from clay to pot. Clay is no, from the standpoint of the clay, there is no pot. There's only clay.
Well, you have to be able to say both. I am the mind.
And I'm free of the mind.
It's easy to say, I am the mind.
Of course it is, because it's the mind talking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's incomplete unless you can say, I am free of the mind. I mean,
you have to say both. Okay, everybody, let's say our prayer.
Do you want me to get to?
Mm-hmm. See everybody Thursday. I'll be home on Thursday and we'll have the Katha Upanishad, part two of the story. Om swasti prajabhya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimmahishaha go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyaha prithivi sasya shalini Desho yam kshobarahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha sarve santu niramayaha sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kaschit dukha bhak bhavet asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotir gamaya mrityor ma amritangamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Harihi Om Om Tat Sat. Okay, everybody. Good night. I'll see you on Thursday, hopefully. Otherwise on Sunday.